Documentary called Transforming Homelessness in Portland. What Can You Do? That is showing Tuesday, February 20th. That's a little less than a week from today, next Tuesday, at 7 p.m. at Portland Community Media at 2766 Northeast MLK. Please join Portland Community Media for the premiere of Transforming Homelessness, a short documentary made by local homeless and housed community members. And there'll be a discussion to follow. For more information, call AFIA at 503-232-0010. That's 503-232-0010, extension 321. And you can come and find out more about that documentary next week. It should be very good. So please check it out. So our show this evening is, again, about the Housing Alliance and activity in Salem in the Oregon legislature to create more housing opportunity. And with me in the studio is Amy Farver from the Neighborhood Partnership Fund and one of the key leaders with the Housing Alliance. Good evening, Amy.
Hello.
How are you doing?
Pretty good.
Very good. Very good. So, first of all, the Housing Alliance. We've talked about the Housing Alliance a number of times in the show. So, for some of our listeners, they'll be aware of what the Housing Alliance is. But let's start there. What is the Housing Alliance?
Well, the Housing Alliance is a coalition of a broad array of organizations and city and county governments that came together about 3 years ago because housing advocates were looking at what was happening up north to our neighbors in the north in Washington and saying, like, well, wow, they're having a lot of success. Why do we keep losing every time we go to Salem? Why aren't we getting the resources that we need from the state? So they started looking at what Washington advocates had done.
And there's an innovative model up there. What are they doing in Washington?
Exactly. It doesn't sound so. It seems common sense, but it really was quite innovative at the time, and still is, I believe. They brought together a broad array of people who don't normally come together to advocate for the same thing. They may be groups that were all interested in housing in some way, but hadn't necessarily come together on a common agenda. So they brought together advocates. They brought together social service agencies from other sectors like the food banks, other social service providers, county governments, local governments, and even some private sector interests. Brought them together to come together around a common agenda of things they could agree on that they wanted to ask the legislature for. And that gave them a lot of strength because it wasn't just housing advocates. It was groups from across the spectrum saying, we all care about this issue, and this is the, you know, five things that we think you should do about it, and we all agree.
So that's something that's very interesting in terms of some of the context personally for me, but then one of the issues that we talk a lot about on this show, which is that need to build broader bridges. And, you know, when I got my start in affordable housing, it was working at a homeless shelter doing frontline work, and I had no idea about what else was going on and how to connect with what was going on. And then I had a series of other housing-related jobs and still felt like, you know, because I left the homeless arena, was in a different arena. And that's the thing. It was a different arena. Mm-hmm. People weren't connected. But it sounds like what the Housing Alliance is doing is creating a forum where these things that, as you said, logically should be connected can be connected.
Right, because even within these advocates who all are working on housing people, you know, they come from it from a different perspective, and they have slightly different interests. And so to find a forum where people can come together and agree on certain things, there may be things that those same people don't agree on in relating to housing, but to focus in on those few items that they all agree on adds a lot of strength to the ask.
Give me an example here about something that members of the Housing Alliance can agree on, and then something that they can't agree on, and maybe a little background to help our listeners understand.
Well, some of the things that they can agree on are a lot of what we'll be talking about later in the show, mm-hmm. our housing opportunity agenda. Mm-hmm. We've agreed that our primary need in the state is more resources. We need more money for affordable housing. There's a strong network of nonprofit housing developers and housing authorities out there who are building affordable housing, they're building great-looking housing that's housing people all over the state. But there just simply aren't enough dollars to fund those projects because you need a pretty big level of subsidy in order to build housing that's affordable for people at the lowest incomes.
So that's the type of issue that whether you are a social service provider, whether you're a county government official, whether you are work for a housing authority, you all see that as a common denominator.
Exactly.
Now, what's an issue that maybe all members of the Housing Alliance can't agree on?
Well, one issue that had come up at the beginning of our coalition that we didn't get agreement on was what to do about state prevailing wage. That's sort of a technical term for what you have to pay people, what public agencies have to pay workers to do construction on projects that are paid for with state or federal dollars. Now, you know, there are housing developers in our coalition, and they care very strongly about what those rules say. But other social service advocates, you know, they don't really care. They may even have a differing opinion. There may be groups who have interest in labor issues or in, you know, fair wage issues, living wage issues that might come at the problem, the issue, from a different direction than the housing developers do. So that's one issue that we haven't found agreement on.
So in other words, though, then what the Housing Alliance is able to achieve is say, let's find the commonalities and focus on those and working together?
Exactly, because in the past we hadn't been able to do that. We got caught up in the things that we couldn't agree on and had a hard time moving forward. So having the Alliance really focus on finding the key elements that we could agree on and only push those forward and, you know, say to people in the coalition, you know, it's okay if you care about these other issues. You just work on them on your own because these are the 5-6 things that the Housing Alliance can agree on, and this is what we're going to pursue.
And this is something that I think is a really important part of this model. I'm in and above the important things that we'll get into specifically about housing. But when I think about a lot of our listening audience out there and thinking about how we get progressives together on various issues. This sounds like an interesting model. One of the things that often divides progressive organizations is there might be certain points where one group will say, if you cross this line, mm-hmm. you know, we'll never work with you. It's signed, sealed, and delivered that you're our enemy. But it sounds like this, the Housing Alliance is saying, let's pull out on the controversial stuff and focus on the common ground.
And one tool that we've used to achieve that is our decision-making model. We have a modified consensus decision-making model. And some people hear the word consensus decision-making and they, you know, they scream.
Why, that's
because
impossible.
It's impossible and it takes forever and you never agree on anything. But our modified consensus decision-making model, I think, has been a key to our success because that means that any issue can come to the table for consideration by the Alliance. And if only even one member organization decides to veto that item or say, no, we don't agree with that, we don't want that to be part of our agenda, then it's off the table. We won't pursue it. But that same group that agreed to veto it or that decided to veto it has to agree to be part of a working group with the people who care about it. So the members that put it forward and want to see the Housing Alliance work on it and the people who are against it have to get together and talk about it and see if they can reach common ground. And, you know, it may very well be that they don't, but at least it forces them to keep talking to each other, which has been a problem in the past. Like you said, when there's the divisions happen, sometimes those are hard to overcome.
So you are tuned in to KBOO. This is Hole in the Bucket. This is Michael Anderson, and I'm joined by Amy Farver of the Housing Alliance in the studio. And we were just talking a little bit about who the Housing Alliance is. Now let's talk about what the Housing Alliance, what are the goals of the Housing Alliance? I think for our listeners in this audience, people are very, very aware that in the Portland metro area, there are a lot of people who've been left behind by the housing market. But the Housing Alliance is a statewide organization. Are people seeing the same problems that we see in Portland around the state?
Absolutely. There's a need for affordable housing in every single county in the state. As of 2005, the National Low Income Housing Coalition does a study every year, and they found that there's not a single county in the state, or actually in the entire country, where a person working 40 hours a week, 52 weeks a year, so full-time work at minimum wage, at the state minimum wage, can afford to rent a two-bedroom apartment. And that's the case in Oregon, and it's probably worse in Oregon than a lot of places because last year, Oregon was the fourth least affordable state in the country.
Wow.
We only trail California, Florida, and New York.
Well, now, I've heard that stat before, but I'm going to ask you the same question people ask me when I say that stat. Well, what do you mean? That's crazy. I know that it's more expensive to live in Massachusetts than Oregon. Well, how could we be ahead of Massachusetts?
Right, you're right. Actual rent levels are higher in a lot of places than here. But our incomes are quite low. So relatively speaking, what somebody can afford to pay in rent is a lot lower in Oregon than it is in other places. And that's really only getting worse. And it's getting worse in rural parts of the state faster than it's getting worse in the metro area. Oregon is increasingly becoming a service sector economy. So you look at what, 10, 20 years ago were a lot of manufacturing jobs, jobs in the timber and fishing industries that were pretty, pretty high paying, decent family wage paying jobs. Those are going away. In some places, they're gone. And when you look at counties in like northeastern Oregon, Wallawa County, Union County, counties that had been relying heavily on timber, now are turning into more and more service sector economy jobs. And those jobs don't pay enough for somebody to rent an apartment. A janitor, a childcare worker, somebody who takes care of you when you're sick, a home health care worker. None of those folks earn enough to rent an apartment, a two-bedroom apartment at the prevailing rate.
You know, I have a good friend who she actually just got her doctorate degree. She teaches in community colleges, and her heart has been at home in Le Grand in Union County for a long time, but she couldn't get a job in the local community college. It was all around the Northwest. Now she and her partner have moved back to Le Grand. She has a full teaching position there, and her partner works in construction, and the two of them can't afford a place to live in Le Grand. And they're gainfully employed, not at the minimum wage, at a higher level. I mean, there's a couple rental places, but they say pretty bottom of the barrel stuff.
Yeah.
Talk about the other sections of the state that are sort of hot spots. I mean, I guess Le Grand, I don't even know if it's a hot spot. But
I think most people don't think of Le Grand as a hot spot. And that's why it's so incredible that, a teacher, a police officer can't afford to buy a home in Le Grand anymore. We think of that as the cheap part of the state to live in. But other parts of the state that are really seeing the boom are the Ashland-Medford area down in Jackson County in the southern part of the state, and then the whole central Oregon region around Bend, Redmond, and now it's spreading out to some of the surrounding communities. They have, if somebody wants to purchase a home, the median home price in both of those counties, Deschutes County and Jackson County, is significantly higher than it is in Portland.
That really blows my mind. Even here, you talk about Bend, Redmond as their associated places. Because I know when I moved to Portland, the concept, I mean, for one, there were a lot less people out there. But for two, conceptually, Bend and Redmond weren't thought of in the same place because Bend was a distinctive housing market, more of a boutique, resort type community. Redmond was more of a small town in central Oregon. But a lot of that's changed because of the pressure on the housing market.
Yeah, and it's changed for a lot of reasons. I mean, they're beautiful places to live, so they're destinations for people who are moving to the state. They're both retiree destinations, so a lot of folks who are cashing out of the equity they've accumulated in their homes in other states. Some are coming from California. Some are coming from Washington. And they have a lot of money to invest in the housing market, so it's inflating the prices. I have a little stat here that I like to share. Curry County, so along the southern coast, an area that really, has no strong economic base anymore. The service sector is the primary employer. That it costs almost $300,000 to buy a house in Curry County.
Wow.
But the average private sector wage of an individual living there is under $25,000. So if you're making $25,000 a year, there is just no way you're ever going to be able to buy a house in Curry County. And, it's primarily because of influx of retirees and from folks who have high-paying jobs but who don't have to live where their jobs are.
Well, stepping back from the home ownership question, which obviously, that literally is the American dream, right? But stepping back from the home ownership question, what's it like for these – I mean, $25,000 isn't a lot of money in any terms. But – when you think about – when you're talking about that kind of inflated home prices, I imagine that is, to quote Ronald Reagan, trickle down into the rental market. talk about that. I mean, if not just in Curry County, is how are renters faring in these property markets?
Well, like I said before, with the shift toward the service sector economy, you know, renters in most counties in the state, if they have your average, you know, it's probably a little bit better than a minimum wage job. It's like I said, it's the sales clerks at the store. It's the folks who are selling groceries. It's the preschool teachers, child care workers, home health aides. They're all struggling. There's no county in the state where those folks can afford a two-bedroom apartment at the fair market rent.
Wow. You know, one of the things that we've talked about on this show is how this crunch on housing affordability particularly can hurt families, and that in the last school year, there were 13,000 children enrolled in our Oregon public schools who did not have a place to call home. In these same communities, I assume that we're even seeing people fall all the way through to homelessness?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, those 13,000 children are just the ones that we've been able to track, you know, in through the school system.
Now, do these smaller towns, do they have shelters and everything?
You know, oftentimes, no. You know, the folks end up, they're homeless. They end up doubling up with other families or bouncing from house to house with friends and relatives. Sometimes they end up living in their cars. Or I've heard anecdotal evidence that a coastal community had a large number of families living in the forest. You know, they were living in tents in the forest and their kids would come out and go to school.
Gosh. I mean, it's, you know, it's funny because I think, you know, going back to that comment about trickle down, is that actually that we now are living at the proof part of the trickle down theory. And I guess the proof is it didn't work, because when you think of families, I mean, 13,000 school children without a place to call home, and at least from what you're describing, I mean, at this point, there is some very serious challenges with the wages and housing costs. And boy, I guess this is a good time to start segueing, is what's to be done? What are the answers to this real horrible quandary we find ourselves in Oregon?
Well, if only I had all the answers. Wouldn't that be nice? But the Housing Alliance is approaching it with our housing opportunity agenda, and we're asking the state legislature to step up and help fill the gap. Now, of course, it's not only the state legislature's problem. I mean, local communities need to step up and address the issue, and of course, we'd like our federal government to do more.
Well, let me ask you a question. You said address the gap. What do you mean there? To explain more to our listeners specifically, because that was maybe a little – I think I know what you mean, but what would the role for government be?
Well, there's a gap in the number of housing units available that are affordable to families at various income levels. So there's an actual physical gap in the number of units. Just in 2005 alone, I learned from the state economist and demographer that – we added 11,000 new families in Oregon that can't afford where they were living. So, you know, about one in four families in Oregon are paying more than they can afford for their housing. And we're keep adding more and more and more.
So
we're not adding affordable units, affordable homes at that same rate.
So this is sort of a basic supply and demand issue where it seems like the market just isn't meeting the demand.
Oh, absolutely. The market isn't meeting the demand because it's much more profitable for developers to build those high-end houses, those big subdivisions that we're seeing going up in communities all over the state, sort of on the fringes within the urban growth boundaries, but sort of on the fringes, those big developments of housing that are the luxury estates that we see advertised on television and on billboards from the highway. And those are profitable for developers. And developers are you know, they're business people. They're out to make their business profitable, and they build to the sector of the economy that pays them well. And right now, it's not profitable for those folks to build units for lower-income families.
So actually, this raises an interesting point for me. So this, in some ways, it seems what you're saying, this would be exactly the argument about why the solution isn't, for instance, taking away the growth boundary. Because what I hear you saying is, for private developers, they're going after where the profit and the money is. And until you do something to address that issue, that's, even if we had all the land in the world, there would probably be just this big boutique estate-type housing being built, because the market really isn't geared towards meeting the more moderate, hey, I'm a working family, I just need a place to call home type of housing.
Right. Yeah, because we're seeing the same problem across the country in communities and states that don't have urban growth boundaries. So it's not a land supply problem.
So then, now what I heard you say, and we'll get into the whole agenda. We're gonna take a break shortly, but before we go into that break, I have one or two more questions, sort of to get the listeners thinking. Then we'll take a little break and get back and really talk about the whole agenda. So, the Housing Alliance is saying we need more funding for housing. Explain to our listeners. I think again, it's the other part of that definition of the gap. What can government money do to make housing more affordable? How is this a good strategy?
It's very expensive to build housing that's affordable to low-income families. You have to subsidize it in some way or another. You either have to subsidize the construction of the house or the apartment complex so that that apartment complex can pay back the loans it has to take out when mm-hmm. it's built. Based on lower rents. So normally when somebody builds an apartment complex, let's use that as an example, they rely on an income stream from rents to pay back the loan.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to have rents that are lower than market or affordable rents, then you have to have something in to fill the gap, or that apartment building won't get built in the first place. The bank won't lend on it because they'll see that they're not going to be able to pay back the loan. So you need to have a smaller size loan that you can afford to pay back with lower rents, and you need some subsidy to buy down the rest of the cost of the construction. So that's one example.
So in that case, that would be, because just going back to because I think gap is a helpful way to understand it. In that way, what you're saying is put some money in either on the construction side or in some other way from the government to close the gap between what people can afford to pay and what the housing actually costs to repay the loan.
Right. So the one just way I described is kind of on the front end for the construction. And then on the other end, you can actually just subsidize the rent itself. So an individual family comes in and can pay, you know, maybe 20% less than the rent actually should be. And then you have some funding stream to pay that difference, to pay that gap.
Like, that's how a Section 8 voucher is
exactly. used. That's exactly how a Section 8 voucher is used. And as we know, the federal government has been cutting funding for the voucher program every year for the past 5 or 6 years.
I forget, is that part of the plan end homelessness or the plan not to leave any child behind? Okay, so in other words, then, the argument for why we need more funding for the government is because working families, seniors, people with disabilities, people with limited incomes need that infusion from some source, that in the public source is the best source, to bring housing from its unaffordable place that it is in the private market to an affordable place to what people actually need.
Right.
Okay. So, well, we are going to take a brief musical break here. This is the band Digital Knife with a song called New Ideas.
Children.
Hello, this is Michael Anderson. We are back with Hole in the Bucket. That was Digital Knife, rocking new ideas. And new ideas, it sounds like the Housing Alliance is bringing some new ideas down to Salem. So now we get to the fun part, because frankly, most of the news is very dismal. Our challenges are huge. The federal government has all but abdicated their responsibility to do anything to house regular people. And so really it's fallen back on the communities. And the community in this case has risen up in a broad way to form this Housing Alliance and go down to Salem and make some change. Talk about the Housing Alliance agenda for the 2007 session.
Great. Well, we have six items on our Housing Alliance agenda that we're working on down in Salem. Our first item, which I think you said is something that you've talked about on this show before, our primary item, the one we're working most actively on right now, is our $100 million for affordable homes. We're asking the legislature to dedicate $100 million of mostly new funding for affordable housing. $60 million of that would come from an increase in the document recording fee. And that's a fee that folks pay right now when they register a title of real property. So if they purchase a home or if they take out a loan on a home, they have to record the title of that piece of land at the county, and they get assessed a fee. So we are asking the legislature to increase that fee by a very small amount and dedicate that money to affordable housing. That would generate about $60 million each biennium. So every 2 years, $60 million in new money that we don't have right now to devote to affordable housing. So that would be huge. The rest of that $100 million would come from, if we're successful, from the lottery proceeds and general fund.
So with the lottery proceeds, would that compete with the schools?
No, not at all. You might have been reading in the paper that the lottery, with the introduction of line games, has been amazingly successful in raising money this year. You know, regardless of what you know, my personal feelings about the lottery might be, it's generated about $200 million more, give or take a little bit, this past biennium than they expected it to. The state constitution dedicates automatically 18% of that money, of all lottery proceeds, automatically go to schools. Another 15% go to a parks and open space fund. So that's to fund state parks around the state. So we would not be asking for any of that money. And both of those accounts, the schools and the parks, are going to see an increase because of this increase in revenues. But, you know, there's the rest of that money out there that is not currently dedicated to either of those uses. And lottery funds, by statute, can only be spent for three purposes. They can be spent for schools, they can be spent for parks, and they can be spent for economic development. And we know that building housing creates jobs. The State Housing Community Services Department did a study that showed that every dollar of state funding that they put into a project generated $16 in economic development activity.
Well, and it would seem to me that not only does it create some jobs with the housing being built and whatever around that, but from what you were saying, workers around this state are having a hard time making it, which for one is going to impact their performance on the job. For two, might mean they have to move out of their community and leave their job because they can't afford to stay there.
Absolutely. We've gotten support from some communities around the state, particularly rural areas, that are losing their worker base. You know, their workers are having to move from coastal communities like over the mountains and commuting two or more hours to get to their jobs so that, you know, they have workers in their communities who can do the things like sell them groceries and teach their kids.
Wait, just to get this straight for a second. So you're telling me it's so bad in certain rural communities that workers are having to drive over the mountains, the same mountains that were in the headlines when that poor family got caught up there. And right now, because of the housing situation and the wage situation, workers are just having to do that as a matter of course?
Yeah, absolutely. When I was down in Medford last summer, I spoke with some folks who work for the huge healthcare system down there. And they were telling us that they have nurses who were commuting from Grants Pass down to Medford and Ashland. Maybe they would, you know, rent an apartment together and crash there, you know, during the weeknights, four or five of them together, and then they'd go home on the weekends to Grants Pass because they couldn't afford to have their families live in the communities where they worked.
That is wild. I mean, I'm thinking about, so who are nurses? Nurses are people who respond to community health needs, oftentimes in really dramatic, urgent situations. And because of the wage housing situation, we're talking about nurses who don't have that comfort of living at home, who are having to crash in a room with a bunch of other nurses or drive multiple hours each day. I mean, that seems like that would really hurt their ability to be effective on the job.
Yeah, same. And it's the exact same situation for police officers and firefighters, other, you know, workers that we count on for our communities to be safe.
So you talked a little bit about where the money was going to come from, the lottery, $100 million total. I have a couple questions related to that. How much does the state currently put in per biennium?
Right now, the state, I'm chuckling here because they currently contribute $5 million every biennium.
Wow.
And that comes from a tax on electric utilities.
Wow. So in other words, I think it's fair to say whatever the intentions or disposition of our state is, right now the state is doing very, very little in terms of a monetary contribution to help Oregon families.
Yeah, for direct grants for housing development, it's only $5 million. They also put in some money, about a little under $7 million, for some homelessness programs that we should give credit
for. That's good.
And a little bit of money, less than $1 million, for homeownership counseling and foreclosure prevention counseling.
So let's put it even in the most optimistic of angles and say that $13 million per every 2 years the state's putting in to try to help alleviate this. So this, no matter how you slice it, we're talking about somewhere between an 8 and 20 time increase to the amount of – wow, that is tremendous. What would this money do? I mean, for our listeners out there – who is this going to help? What will this change?
This money will impact people on both ends and in between on this housing spectrum, as I like to think of it. We have money going to homeless to increase the spending for homeless prevention programs. So that's emergency rent assistance. It's counseling. It's helping people stabilize once they're in housing. So formerly homeless people, once they get into housing, sometimes need some help services to be able to stay in that housing and be successful once they're there. Not everybody does, but some do. And we want to have funding available to help them.
What's an example of that? What kind of services?
It could be addiction counseling. It could be mental health counseling. It's really having services available to help meet the person wherever they are.
So it's interesting that to think about handling these issues from a housing perspective, because again, some of the addiction counseling, mental health services, these are some of the other essential societal infrastructure stuff that we've seen cut at the state level.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Okay, wow.
Absolutely.
So the Housing Alliance has made that as part of their agenda.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, that's great.
Yep, we want to work on addressing homelessness and then all the way through to folks who are ready for home ownership. So the next step along the way is once people get out of homelessness, they need an affordable rental unit. So the bulk of the money we would like to see go to direct grants for development of affordable housing and preservation of affordable housing. We have a lot of affordable housing throughout the state, particularly in rural areas, that was built in the 60s and the 70s through HUD, Housing and Urban Development, which is a federal agency, and Rural Development, which is another federal agency under the U.S. Department of Agriculture. They had big housing production programs in the 60s and 70s that had time limits on the affordability period. So when those units were built, the owners had to agree to keep them affordable for 30 or 40 years. Well, now we're at the end of those 30 or 40 years. And we're at a point where we risk losing, you know, thousands of units of affordable housing if we don't step in and do something. So we'd like to see some of the money not only go to building more affordable housing, but to making sure that the affordable housing that we currently have stays affordable and is in good repair.
You know, I mean, I have to say, this is one of those issues that makes me just hop right up on my soapbox. And luckily, I'm on the radio, so a lot of people are going to hear me. But, you know, it does seem that this is a really essential thing for us to do, preserve this affordable housing we already have. It's so much, as you were saying, the cost of construction and everything, housing is expensive. And so if we already have housing that's there and we can more, for a more reasonable cost, fix it up mm-hmm. and keep it affordable, boy, we got to do it. But the thing I got to get up on my soapbox about is, you know, back in this the same kind of theory of trickle-down economics, you know, this federal government had made some decisions in the past 30, 40 years about how to fund affordable housing. And it was these tax credit plans or Section 8 funded plans that had these expiring contracts. Just for clarification for our listeners, if you're an owner of one of these affordable housing contracts and you're getting out of it on the end, is it a lucrative business for you? So, okay, I'll answer my own question. Here's the thing, listening audience. The people who own these affordable housing projects through these Section 8 or tax credit programs, private owners, really are in a position right now where they can make a lot of money going, taking these off into the private market. And so to have programs that help keep it affordable and still essentially pay people a market value is something that we have to have. But I guess what I'm saying is it sort of drives me crazy that we had a system where the government made an initial investment in partnership with private investors, and then this timetable ends, and then the private investors are really in the catbird seat as far as what they do next.
Yeah, I was silent there for a moment because I wasn't quite sure what you were asking me, but I'm going to disagree with you just a little bit.
Yeah,
I agree with you completely that in hot market areas like the Portland metro area and some of these other hot spots around the state that we talked about along the coast and in the Ashland-Medford area and in the Central Valley or central part of the state, Bend, Redmond, that's the case. Folks selling these units at the end of their affordability periods stand to make a ton of money. And so that makes our challenge of preserving them as affordable that much harder. But there's a lot of places in the state where that's really not the case. Especially a lot of the rural development projects that were built in tiny towns in eastern Oregon, there's not really a huge market there. And part of the problem is that it doesn't pay for the current owners to sell them because they stand to have to pay a bunch of taxes on the property. These weren't really huge money-making ventures. You know, they probably did okay on them. You know, they had a steady income. But oftentimes the owners or the folks who built them were local business people who really actually did want to contribute something to their communities. And now, you know, they're at a point where they'd like to get out, but it's not cost effective for them to. And so they're put in a position where they're choosing to not necessarily keep the building up because they're sinking money into something that's not paying them back. So if we can come up with opportunities for nonprofit housing developers to purchase those units at a fair price and then invest some money to fix them up, then it's really a win-win situation. It's a win for the rural owners who maybe are at the point where they're ready to retire and need some income for their retirement in these small communities, and it's a win for the community because that 10 units of affordable housing for seniors is the only 10 units of affordable housing in that community.
Well, that's a good clarification, and I appreciate you pushing me back on that. Let me be a little bit more specific, and then we can move on. I think maybe what my real point is not to bang on the individual owners who invested in these properties. Maybe that's where I was mistaken in what I was trying to articulate, but more it just seems so frustrating to me that we invested all this tax money 30, 40 years ago initially, then mm-hmm. over this whole time period, and that then these contracts end.
Yeah, and then we have to invest again.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. But that said, preservation is a great use of public money because it's, as you're saying, it's taking this housing that is either at risk of being dilapidated or in hot housing markets becoming, you know, new condos or whatever it's going to be. And this is a very affordable way that we can mm-hmm. create housing opportunity.
Yeah.
Great. So, okay, I'm off my soapbox now, back onto the earth, my feet firmly planted. So the $100 million, we've talked about how it's going to help around homelessness, around affordable rental property, around home ownership. One of the other things, and I know this is, I think, part of the homeless piece, but I think what I would also like to hear you share with our listeners is there's money for short-term emergency rent assistance. Well, I guess they call it different things mm-hmm. in different parts of the state, but that's a really important pool of money. Could you talk a little bit about that and yeah. how it works?
That's the money that currently goes through the state, and it's allocated to counties, to the community action agencies in every county, and they're called different things in every county. Portland Impact, I believe, is one of the ones here in the metro area.
Or Multnomah County. Is the whole county. But they're around the state.
In smaller counties or less populated counties around the state, there may just be one agency that administers these funds. And they, usually run out of this emergency rent assistance, a couple days or a week into the month. So they have a new allocation of funding on the first of the month, and they get flooded with requests because there's so much more need for it than there is money. And the money's gone, midway through the month.
So just for definition's sake, what is emergency rent assistance? Give me an example of when it might be used.
Well, it could be used in any time when somebody, is short for a month. So maybe they got laid off from their job and they didn't get to work as many hours that particular month and they're facing eviction. So they may have missed their rent payment on the first of the month, and they may have gotten a, 30-day eviction notice for non-payment of rent. And they can go to their community action agency and ask for help, and they might get a one-time assistance payment to cover that gap so that they can have a little bit more time to breathe and hopefully regain their footing and be able to pay their rent on time the next month and avoid homelessness.
So, in other words, it's a real tool to make sure that people don't fall all the way down to in the streets or piling their family into the car.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Unfortunately, there's such a shortage of those funds that it's often, if you're lucky enough to get it at all, if you're lucky enough to get in the door before those funds run out each month, it's probably a one-month fix. And so your situation, if it hasn't changed and you're still in an apartment or a home that you can't really afford anymore, then you need to start looking for other solutions. And that's the problem right now, is there really aren't a lot of other solutions.
But it sounds like this emergency rent assistance to increase it, at least as the Housing Alliance hopes to mm-hmm. with this $100 million package, would go a long way to giving families
that freedom. We would almost double the dollars that are available for community action agencies. Now, not all of that would necessarily go into this emergency rent assistance. There's a whole array of programs out there. But it would certainly have a huge impact on the number of families who would have that emergency assistance they need to avoid being homeless.
So it also sounds like that's got to be something that's a great efficiency from a social and government level. I mean, instead of having, if a family does become homeless, do the kids go out of school? Do other things happen where you're mm-hmm. bringing in social workers and whatnot? Mm-hmm. Whereas if you can just let people say, all right, Jimmy broke his arm unexpectedly, you had this medical bill, it ate into your rent money, but you're going to be able to stay in your place, and then you'll get back on.
You can get back on your feet.
Back on your feet. Mm-hmm. So that's a really, really great part of this $100 million. Well, we got about 10 minutes left here, which always on the show, I should have spent less time in the soapbox. We still have a number of things that I want to talk to you about that are in the agenda. Another one besides the $100 million is about lifting a ban on inclusionary zoning.
Mm-hmm.
What is that, and why do we want to lift the ban on it?
All right. Well, inclusionary zoning is a great tool to increase the supply of affordable housing. It's a technical term, but it's a really simple concept. It means that a local jurisdiction would pass an ordinance, so pass a local rule for their community that says that as a condition of development, developers must include a certain percentage of units affordable to a certain income level in every development. And the actual parameters are different in every community across the country that has one of these. So some places, they say that every apartment complex that's over 10 units large, so more than 10 apartments in the complex, has to have 25% of those units be affordable to families earning some
X
particular
amount
that is deemed affordable or deemed, that would struggle to pay a market rent. In other communities, they put those restrictions also on home ownership units. So it really is a variable tool, and every community does it differently based on their local needs. But the key is that it's flexible, and it has a very low cost associated with it. It doesn't require the same level of dollar subsidy that we talked about before. It requires developers to include a array of units that meet the needs of the array of families that live in that community. So they can't just build all toward the high end. They have to build, a variety of options.
Now, I know that the home builders in particular strongly oppose inclusionary zoning because they feel like, well, that's you're making developers pay more. The way that I've always thought about it, though, is that it seems like already if, say, you're the city of Portland and someone's building an apartment complex in Portland, the city of Portland already put in the streets, the sewers. The city of Portland already has the transportation system, the school, on and on. That in some ways this is more just asking developers to do their share.
Mm-hmm. And it's funny you mentioned developers. They are, in general, opposed to it. The reason we're asking for a ban to be lifted is because in the 1999 legislative session, that year Multnomah County started doing some research and looking around and looking what other communities were doing around inclusionary zoning, thinking, well, this might be a tool that we want to consider. And the home builders weren't very happy about that because they saw this, as you said, as cutting into their profits and placing the burden on them. So they were able to get the legislature at the very end of that session to pass a law banning this practice in the entire state of Oregon. We are the only state in the country that has such a ban, except for Texas. Texas has a ban as well. Other than that, it's just Oregon. And I think the problem with that is that, the lack of a ban doesn't mean that communities have to do this. It doesn't mean that, every community in Oregon is suddenly going to have an inclusionary zoning policy and suddenly every developer in the state is going to have to do this. But it gives local governments a tool that they don't otherwise have that doesn't require them to spend a ton of money.
And are there communities that are involved with the Housing Alliance that are ready or interested in passing this?
Yeah, Ashland down in Southern Oregon is really interested in this. And I think that I don't know what their local council would do, but I know that it's very likely that they would pass such an ordinance if permitted. And so right now, basically, the state legislature is saying to Ashland, you don't really know what you want for your community. We're not going to let you do what you think is right. We're going to decide for you because the home builders don't like it. I mean, that's essentially what we're saying.
Yeah. So, okay. So we got $100 million. We got lift the ban on inclusionary zoning. I know that the Housing Alliance is doing some stuff on condominium conversion.
We are. We have an array of requests before the legislature that protect people who are displaced from their affordable home because of a variety of actions. So one of those is a condominium conversion. So somebody who's living in, let's say, an apartment in Northeast Portland. I live in Northeast Portland, and every day I ride my bike to work and I notice, what had been a nice little brick garden style apartment building is suddenly getting a facelift. And I know what that means. It means sooner than rather than later, I'll see the for sale sign.
Condo
because
time.
Those apartments have been made into condominiums and put on the market at a rate that's generally too high for the current residents to afford. Sometimes they're affordable from a home ownership perspective, which isn't a bad thing, but they're displacing some very vulnerable people. Oftentimes, those are apartments that are just because they're older, maybe they haven't had as much fixing up in the last 10 years. They're just lower cost rental units. And when the people are displaced from them, they incur huge costs. They have to pay to move. Moving's pretty expensive. And they've got to pay first month, last month, and a deposit at a new place. And even if they can find a new apartment that has the same rent, which is pretty unlikely, in at least in Northeast Portland right now, they still have these huge costs associated with moving. And, you know, when you're talking about a low-income family that's, you know, living month to month as it is, oftentimes those costs are just enough to push them over to the edge into homelessness or, you know, having to crash with a family member.
The Housing Alliance is also doing some work on manufactured home park closures.
Yeah, thank you. That's right. So that's the other end of it. It's the same idea. People who are displaced from their affordable home because of a private market action. So in that case, the owner of a manufactured home park in the Portland metro area, at least, may decide to cash out. You know, land in the metro area is worth a lot of money right now. And so they may decide to sell that manufactured home park and make a lot of money. But the folks who live there are kind of left out in the cold because they own that manufactured home. They don't own the land beneath it. Oftentimes, particularly with older manufactured homes, they can't move them anywhere because a lot of the parks won't accept the older homes. Even if they can move it, you know, it costs $15,000 to $20,000 to move a manufactured home because, you know, we call them mobile homes or we call them trailers, but they're not mobile. If you've looked at any manufactured home park lately, those are units that don't move.
Well, you know, and I've often thought too that manufactured home parks, because of that, what you're describing, you know, people invest money like they're buying a piece of real property, but really they're just getting the physical structure, and boy, the carpet can be yanked out.
And it's, you know, and manufactured home parks are a really great source of affordable housing. I think the state has a statistic that, you know, over two-thirds of the folks who live in manufactured home parks are over 55 years old. They earn less than $30,000 a year.
So retirees.
And they like their communities. Wow. You know, they really like where they live. And so it's really a struggle when they're forced to move, you know, that late in life. So the Housing Alliance is asking the legislature to step in and install protections in law for folks who are displaced from their homes by no fault of their own. We're asking in both cases for increased notification so that folks have more advance notice that they are going to have to move and that they have an opportunity for relocation assistance so that the owner, who's really standing to make a whole lot of money on this, the sale of that property, has to pay a little bit to the person who's displaced from their home to help defray the costs.
Well, you know, this whole agenda sounds very, very encouraging and something that I think our listeners will probably want to know how they can get involved in. And seeing that the show is wrapping up, we're going to have to get to that stage. So if we have listeners who've been tuning in tonight who want to know how to get involved with the Housing Alliance, is there a website? Is there a number that people can call?
Yeah, I'll give you all that information. You can go to our website. It's the Oregon Housing Alliance. So it's www.oregonhousingalliance.org. So it's all one word, oregonhousingalliance.org. Or you can call me at work. My phone number is 503-226-3001, extension 102. And you can also call your legislator. You can call your representative. You can call your senator. And you can ask them to pass the Housing Opportunity Agenda. Senate Bill 38 is the bill that we have right now coursing through the legislature that would increase the document recording fee and generate that $60 million for affordable housing. So you can call your legislator and ask them to vote yes on Senate Bill 38.
So yes on 38, listeners out there, if you have the opportunity this evening, get online. Oregon State Legislature has a great website. Give you the number to call. Take some time tomorrow. Call your representative. Call your senator. Say, let's pass SB 38. Let's increase housing opportunity. Amy, it's been a pleasure having you in the studio tonight. Best of luck in Salem. Maybe we can have you call in to a later show and give us an update once stuff starts moving.
That would be great.
Yeah, and the website again, www.oregonhousingalliance.org. And if you want to get a hold of Amy, you can call her at 503-226-3001. This is Michael Anderson. This has been Hole in the Bucket. Thank you for tuning in to your community radio station, KBOO 90.7. Keep on rocking.